Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
Let's jump right into this lawsuit with our Week in Review panelists. Joining me now in studio is Michael Curry. He's the former president of the Boston NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Hello, Michael. Good to see you.
Good to be here.
Also with us is Jennifer Nasur. She's former chair of the Mass GOP and current CEO of Reflect Us, a nonpartisan coalition of leading women's organizations. Hello, Jennifer. Good to see you.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with what we heard there from Deb about A.G. Healey's suit against Purdue and the Sacklers. What do you make of the details that are coming out here? Jennifer, I'll start with you.
You know, it's amazing, and amazing not in a fabulous, wow, this is great news, amazing in just a horrifying way. I mean, you know, a doctor prescribing more than 500 prescriptions for Oxy in New Bedford is unbelievable. But I think what's even more unbelievable is, you know, you hope that the TV series that you watch on Netflix are all make-believe and that people are really using their money for good and not for evil and investing in our hospitals and investing in our communities and in the arts and culture and trying to lift people up. And this is investing to destroy lives and to destroy families. And I find that that's really repulsive.
So, Michael, what do you hear in that?
Yeah, you know, one is I think, you know, we've been trying to tackle this healthcare challenge for a while, and it's the fraud, the abuse, the waste in the system. And I think pharmaceutical industry is one where I think A.G. Healey, credit to her, credit to Governor Baker, who've all tried to attack this problem in different ways. In Massachusetts, we've talked about pharmacy detailing, and that's the chat, you know, the relationships that doctors have and trying to steer doctors, pharmaceutical salesperson to try to steer doctors to sell certain products, but to use or prescribe certain products. We have a challenge in this country. There is so much money in the pharmaceutical industry. Some regulatory oversight's needed. I think we're headed in that direction. We've made great strides here in Massachusetts. I think the health reform bill is probably being crafted as we speak in the legislature. Needs to take a look at this as well.
So Purdue says that Healey's complaint unfairly singles them out, though, and, you know, blaming them for the entire opioid crisis. And one of the arguments that's made is, I think we're talking about here, is that the pharmacies and drug distributors, Walgreens, you know, CVS, they knew they were selling too many pills. And so I'm just curious if you think there's any merit to the fact that there are a lot of hands in this pot.
Yeah, definitely. But, I mean, I think that they've been profiting a lot off of people becoming addicted to their product. And so, you know, you look at it and say, okay, maybe it's a class, you know, maybe it's a larger class, but they are the beginning. They are the root to the problem. And it doesn't appear from any of the findings so far and any of the pleadings that they didn't have a gigantic hand in getting this started and pushing it more and more.
And I think it's simply a matter of there likely are many others doing the same thing, but this was pretty egregious. And they're appropriately so, we're making an example of them. And I think the attorney general, credit to her for going after them.
So I want to read something that Richard C., he's a commenter on our website. We don't normally do this, but here's his comment. In another setting, this story would be chronicled as the exploits of a top-tier narco-trafficker and the mules. Michael, what do you make of that comment?
I mean, it is what it is. I think we sometimes give this sort of white-collar approach to the crimes as being less devastating on communities and families. In fact, for the people who are trafficking drugs on the street, or people who have a license to do it and a company behind them, we need to treat them the same. If they're hurting our communities, creating substance abuse in our communities, I think it's legitimate comparison.
Even if they're the people who build museums and art galleries.
Even if they are.
Yeah. Well, so on our show here Wednesday, Deb Becker hosted this great hour with the top three law enforcement officials here in Boston, Sheriff Stephen Tompkins, BPD Commissioner William Gross, and District Attorney Rachel Rollins, all African-American. And I want to play a clip here of what DA Rollins said about how we treat the opioid crisis versus how drug epidemics in the past have been viewed by the public.
when it was people that look like individuals on this side of the table, and I am referring to the three black people that are on your show, nobody cared about the fact that the crack epidemic or heroin was ravaging our communities and people were addicted and they were just sent to jail.
I'd like to get your response to that, Jennifer.
You know, it's difficult because I'm not a member of the black community, and but I, you know, am a mother, mm-hmm. and I had a sibling who had some drug issues, and I look at this and say, you know, I wish that this was always an issue. I think part of the problem that no one recognizes is that, you know, gay marriage was only recognized in 2003 in Massachusetts. We hid people in the closet, per se, based on their sexual orientation. Women, we're just getting to a point where, you know, it's not you're a woman, so this is your gender role. Drugs have had, I think, the same exact position in life where, ooh, no one wants to talk about it. Because if we talk about cocaine or we talk about heroin, then, you know, our neighbors might find out mm-hmm. that our kids are doing it. And so no one wanted to talk about all the bad stuff. Well, welcome to 2019. And these are all issues. It doesn't matter whether you're what your gender is. It doesn't matter your sexual preference. It doesn't matter your age. And it doesn't matter the color of your skin. And I think the problem that we face in society a lot today is, well, you didn't have to face this. Well, you know what? We're all facing this today. Mm-hmm. So why don't we all come together under a big tent and fix the problems instead of being concerned about what happened in the past?
So go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, I was going to say race matters. As many of us try to argue in every place that'll listen, race matters. My sister was a crack addict growing up, and I can tell you firsthand as a family member that the crack addicts in my community in Roxbury, Dorchester, in Southside Chicago, in St. Louis, they did not treat them with the compassion that they're now treating those mm-hmm. who are addicted to opioids. And that's a relationship between power and race, is that when the lawyers, the doctors, the DAs are white, they tend to look at people who are using crack as the scourge of society, lock them up, put them away. And if they're using powder cocaine and some other illicit drug in the suburbs, it's we need to take care of that young man or woman and not ruin their career. Truth is finally catching up to history in this case.
So it sounds like both of you have personal experiences with the ravages of addiction and drugs, and thank you for sharing those experiences. I want to stick with this topic a little bit more here and maybe shift gears a little bit to talk about supervised injection sites, this idea that there would be a place where people could go and use drugs under medical supervision, because I think it plays into what we're talking about. And this week, U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling told us on Radio Boston that he would prosecute any effort to open such a facility here in Massachusetts.
If the public decides that it really wants these sites, its fight is not with me. Its fight is with Congress. On my end, I have a federal statute that on its face would make this illegal, and I'll enforce it.
And Boston Mayor Marty Walsh says the state is not ready for such sites, but that they could have a potential to save lives.
I'd suggest the U.S. Attorney, and all people, if you get a chance to go and take a visit of these sites and just go and listen, there's something there. I mean, I'm a person that was, a year ago, very adamantly opposed to even the idea of these sites.
So with all of what we've been talking about in mind, Jennifer, I'll start with you. What's your take on this idea of a supervised injection site coming to Massachusetts?
Well, you know, I think one of the things that the mayor had expressed concern over is that in Canada, when he went up there, it is a government-funded program, and it's run by government-funded and paid nurses mm-hmm. and licensed medical personnel. You know, we don't have the infrastructure for that. We don't know who would fund it. And, you know, where are they located? And I live in Boston and, mm-hmm. you know, as marijuana shops are popping up, parents are having heart attacks over this, right? So I think that, you know, it becomes a much larger conversation and something that should be thought about. But I think more importantly, which is what the U.S. Attorney General had said, is that it's illegal to do drugs and to come up with areas of okay, well, you could do them safely here. Why don't we try to find ways to get people off of them? Because I'm not really super convinced that people are not going to still be doing it in their homes and that they're just going to go to these sites.
Well, and the research is sort of mixed on this. We were struggling to find a clear answer of whether they help or work. And I do want to pick up on something you were saying about the funding, because we spoke to someone who is an opinion writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer. This Philadelphia is a city that is looking into bringing supervised injection sites to their city. And so let's listen to Abraham Gutman.
There should be taxpayer money going to this. One thing that is often glanced on when we talk about overdose prevention sites is that they save a lot of money.
So he's referring to healthcare cost savings, for instance. Michael, you're in the industry.
Yep.
Tell me your thoughts on this.
So I think, you know, it's interesting. I spent some time with this topic because I wanted to understand it. I actually reached out to Dr. Gaeta, who is at the Boston Healthcare for Homeless, one of the Harm Reduction Commission members of this commission that was created by the legislature in 2018 to look at this issue. And he shared some of the data. I think it's compelling, the research that came out of Vancouver. It showed a 60% reduction in mortality rates within a certain miles of the supervised injection facilities. It showed a reduction in costs. It showed a cost-benefit analysis that it actually looked at from Baltimore, I think, used the Vancouver study. And it showed that there was a reduction in inpatient days, in emergency room use. Now, intuitively, it doesn't feel good to think about creating a space for people to use drugs. But we're at a point that has been said, this is life or death.
Right.
And if we can save money, save lives, I think credit to the mayor for being open-minded enough to even consider it.
But mortality rates, costs. I do want to ask, though, getting back to the legality point, I take it you're both lawyers.
Yep.
So this is the perfect panel for today. Because Lelling said there at the top, we were just hearing from him, that this is illegal, according to him. Others are saying the law is not as clear. And you mentioned, Jennifer, marijuana here in Massachusetts. This isn't the only state to legalize recreational marijuana. That is also illegal. So I guess my question is, at some point, does a state have to do what a state has to do to protect lives?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, he said he finds it to be two totally different things. And then, you know, it's a slippery slope. Do you say, okay, I think we could all agree, the legislature did not decide on marijuana.
Right.
So that went to the ballot. Ballot questions are purposefully made to not be understandable by about 90% of the people who are out voting. Right. Might be 99.9% of people who are voting on them.
We hope they listen to Radio Boston where we help explain the ballot questions.
And so unless our legislature either self-imposes term limits and we get people in there who actually decide that they want to tackle subjects like this, I don't think that an issue like this should ever go to be on a ballot, because I think that it would be very confusing and you run down a slippery slope of then, you know, having needles in your backyard. So I have concerns.
And I appreciate that this is federal law, but there is examples, right? This is all about discretion. As a U.S. attorney,
right,
you can prosecute for these cannabis sites that we have in Massachusetts because it's a federal crime. You can actually prosecute someone who's turning in a gun at a gun turn-in facility. The law has a lot of discretion. This is another example where this U.S. attorney can turn a blind eye and say, hey, Massachusetts is doing something forward-thinking, and we're not going to spend our resources just like we don't on marijuana to prosecute these cases. He clearly is creating a difference that there is no difference in this case.
So just one last point on this topic, because it's huge and it's important, and thank you for sticking with us on this. What else do you think we should be doing then to combat this crisis? Michael, I'll start with you.
Yeah, you know, it's funny having the example both of us have of personal family members. I think one is mental health, right? This is all tied to mental health because people self-medicate. So we got to get in and provide services. The mental health system is still broken. Mm-hmm. People do not have access to care. They can't pay the co-pays, or they can't find a provider that takes their insurance, or they don't have insurance. The reality is we got to address that underlying issue of mental health. And then I think the governor, to his credit, Boston mayor and some mayors across the state are doing some innovative things in providing services and life-saving measures to help people with addictions.
Jennifer?
Yeah, I'm with Michael there. I think that, honestly, the biggest issue is that 20, 30 years ago, when mental health was defunded to the extent that it was, and we closed hospitals and we did not invest any more in training those professionals who could help the people who needed to be helped. And, you know, I think that that is actually the biggest problem that we have. And if we're going to do anything and we're going to change this, it has to start with the mental health, because if you're not helping the people who will automatically become addicted to any substance that they're given, mm-hmm. it will never change.
Well, this is an important conversation that we will continue here at WBUR and continue to report on. I do want to touch in on one more Week in Review story this week, the MBTA. Considering a fare hike this year of 6.3%, here's General Manager Steve Poftak.
This is, I think, a modest fare increase. It keeps pace with inflation. I also think doing it on a periodic basis where the rise is not quite so dramatic, you know, I'm hopeful that this lands a little bit easier.
Governor Charlie Baker, a Republican, says he supports the hike.
Let's not forget that the taxpayers who never ride the system write a check every year for over $1 billion to the MBTA. And the trade on that is that fares need to cover about 40% of their operations.
But State Senator Nick Collins, who represents Dorchester and Mattapan, says that this conflicts with the central mission of the MBTA.
A fare increase would not only be unfair to riders, it would also drive away many potential users and current users from the system, worsening traffic on our roads and driving increased emissions, thereby subverting the mission of public transit.
So this would be the fourth price increase on the T since 2012. What do you think? Goldilocks here. Too much, too little, just right, Jennifer?
I mean, it's, you know, you're talking 5 cents, 10 cents, you know. I feel like we're doing the chicken dance, right? Yeah. 5 cents.
But it adds up to real money. I mean, a monthly pass would raise by $5 to 90 bucks a month.
Yeah. However, you know, I think that we can all agree we have some issues in our transit system, and that in order for it to be fixed, we need to spend some money. We need to raise some revenue somewhere. And, you know, just like as I'm not opposed to, as a driver, I'm not opposed to paying tolls to pay for those roads, I think that the same thing happens with the MBTA.
Michael?
Yeah, I think, you know, we're at a place now where I think about the young lady I saw on the train today on the red line, who was a mother pushing her baby, probably early 20s. This is what Nick Collins pointed out. Credit to Senator Collins for pointing out the inequity in this. If you're poor and you're using the T system within the city of Boston or the T system broadly, this is a increase for you. Mm-hmm. I think this goes back to our former governor and the conversation we need to have, that this is no longer Taxachusetts. We need to look at some revenue to improve our infrastructure, including our transportation system, and not put it on the backs of the people who are using the system. Let's invest the money, but let's find the tax that we, you know, this governor may be opposed to taxes, maybe not assessments, but to taxes. We need to find a way to find the money to invest in our transportation system.
So you think gas tax?
No, I hate taxes. Come on, I'm a Republican here. You're like, you're making me go into a sweat. Are you kidding, Jamie? Come on.
I'm trying. No, because I did some back of the envelope, you know,
going to have to start happy hours at 3:30 instead.
But, you know, if this goes into effect, they say there'd be about 1.3% ridership decrease. That's like 15,000 people on the road. So.
And not even talk about the carbon imprint, footprint. We're trying to do environmental, you know, work environmentally, and this is not.
But I hesitate. Well. I really hesitate to think that anyone's going to pay for their gas and pay for tolls and sit in traffic as opposed to paying an extra 10 cents or 5 cents to take public transportation. I also find it hard to believe that anyone who can't afford those increases are able to then afford the car to pay the gas and the maintenance on the car to get to work.
This is only the beginning. This is the increase.
Just suggesting, yeah. we're like rapidly running out of time here, but I do want to squeeze in the hubbubs real quick, so can we make them fast, Jennifer? Yeah.
Yes, I found it really super interesting that Gillette is thinking of selling their property over at Four Point Channel, 6.5 acres, and oh my, over $200 million for it. How many more people can we squeeze into the city?
You know what? We always talk about inclusion, but guess what? The product of inclusion is we have to change how we talk. The legislature just voted in their rules changes to eliminate words like chairman and use chair. And instead of saying maiden speech, it's inaugural speech. It's good for us to change language. And I'm very proud of all the women that have now I've been elected to the state legislature.
Yes.
Hear, hear. And my hubbub, I'm going to make it very fast. I just want to remember someone who recently passed. Jacqueline Steiner died at the end of last week. She was 94. She wrote most of the lyrics to the song that was popularly known as Charlie and the MTA. We were just talking about fare increases. So in honor of Steiner, let's go into this break with the Kingston Trio version of 1959 from 1959 of MTA protesting a rise in fares. Michael Curry, he's the former president of Boston NAACP and a member of the National NAACP Board of Directors. Thanks for coming in.
I'm glad to be here.
And Jennifer Nassour, former chair of the Mass GOP and current CEO of Reflect Us, a nonpartisan coalition of leading women's organizations. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna.